The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how happy the internet is. Dave, how do you tell the happiness of a network?
Well, it's a good question, Rob. And what you have to do, or at least what these researchers did, was they scanned over 2 million blogs and over 200,000 song lyrics that had been posted on the internet. And the reason they did this is they were trying to gauge the level, not really of how happy the internet is, but how happy society is. And it's actually a much harder question to answer than you would think because, you know, when psychologists want to figure out if one person or a small group of people is happy or sad, they'll hand out questionnaires or they'll conduct individual interviews. But you obviously can't do that with millions of people. So these guys said, well, let's turn to blogs and song lyrics. And the reason they chose those is because those tend to be outlets for personal expression on the internet, especially blogs. People are writing a lot about how they're feeling on a particular day. And with songs, they're, you know, also writing about their feelings. And the researchers also considered that these outlets would be more honest than a conversation with a psychologist because people wouldn't feel like they were being interviewed. They would sort of feel more open to discuss, you know, in a blog or a song lyric, maybe especially in a blog, how they really felt.
Still sort of a self-selected group, though, right? I mean, there must be some characteristics of bloggers that don't apply maybe to everybody else. I mean, they're affluent. They have money to be on the computer. They have time to be on the computer.
Well, it's a good point, Rob. And clearly, this isn't a random sample of all of society. We are dealing with a specific segment here. But for the purposes of this study, this is really as close as researchers feel like they're going to get in terms of getting this really broad sample of feelings out there.
So how did the researchers get the feelings of all of these blogs and song lyrics?
Well, they utilized a site called wefeelfine.org. And this is a site that searches blogs across the internet for versions of the phrase, I feel. And so it looks for the phrase, I feel, and then it looks for the rest of the sentence. So maybe the sentence ends with, you know, I feel good or I feel terrible. And the researchers actually had about a list of 1,000 emotion words that they were specifically focused on, you know, and they ranked them from a score of 1 being miserable to 9 being ecstatic. So the words that got very high scores were words like triumphant and love. And words that got very low scores were words like disgusted.
So these are English-speaking blogs and song lyrics from around the world.
Around the world. And what the researchers found with the blogs is that there's good news with the blogosphere, and that is that the blogosphere has gotten significantly happier over the past 4 years. And the researchers scanned blogs back to 2005. So over the past 4 years, they've seen about a 4% uptick in happiness as measured by the happiness scores for the words that they're seeing in these blogs. So that's the good news. And they found interesting correlations with specific dates. So, you know, days like Christmas and Valentine's Day tended to have higher scores. And days like the September 11th anniversaries and most recently Michael Jackson's death tended to have lower scores. So they did see these correlations. And the happiest day that they found so far was November 4th, 2008, which was when Barack Obama was elected president of the U.S.
What about song lyrics?
Well, song lyrics actually showed the opposite trend. Song lyrics, and they went back to about 1960 with the song lyrics, have gotten much more negative, which is probably not a surprise to anybody who follows popular culture over the last 4 or 5 decades. What they found is that the highest scores they were seeing were around 1961. That's when they were seeing a lot of songs that had love in the lyrics. But starting around 1980, things started to get a lot more negative. They were seeing a lot more songs that had the words hate and pain in them. And they're saying that it's not really because there are any really different genres of music around now than there were then, although there were a few more. It's just that the genres that tend to be thought of as more negative, like, say, heavy metal or punk music, have just grown more popular. And so they're getting more representation in the popular culture, and you're seeing a lot sort of more of these quote-unquote negative lyrics. And the thought is that they're representing negative emotions.
What was the intention of the researchers in doing this? I imagine this kind of data would be very interesting, potentially, to marketers.
Well, there's some interesting correlations you can do with this data. For instance, do musicians with more positive lyrics sell more CDs? Or do people in countries with more positive bloggers live longer? Because there's been some correlation studies that have suggested that happier people tend to live longer. So there's some interesting correlations you can do here. And those are some points raised by an outside expert. But as far as the researchers themselves, they're interested in right now and moving on to Twitter, you know, the very popular social networking site. And the advantage of looking at Twitter versus looking at blogs is Twitter is even more immediate. So they can sort of track minute by minute happiness rather than looking, you know, even day by day. So it'll be interesting to see where this research goes.
Okay. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from looking at levels of happiness around the world to looking at sensitivity to sugar and sweet taste around the world. Rob, this next study is about differences in our ability to taste sweet foods. And it turns out not everybody is the same.
Is this a nature or a nurture question?
Well, this is a nature question. It actually has to do with a gene called TAS1R3. And this is a gene that plays a major role in encoding a carbohydrate sweet taste receptor. So something that's very important for our ability to taste whether something is sugary or not. And for this study, researchers want to find out, do people of certain ancestry have more sensitivity to sugar than people of other types of ancestry? And so what they did was they took up 144 people from various ethnic backgrounds, and they gave them a bunch of sugar solutions. Some of these solutions had no sugar at all, and some of them were up to 4% sugar. And they had them taste all the solutions and say, how sweet does this taste to you? And right off the bat, they noticed a difference. They noticed that people that had European ancestry tended to view the sugary solutions as much more sugary or much more sweet tasting than people of, say, Asian ancestry or Middle Eastern ancestry or especially African ancestry. People with African ancestry tended to be the least sensitive to sugary taste. And the researchers correlated it to this gene, TAS1R3. And it turns out that there's these subtle genetic variations that are associated with these genes. And they found that people with European ancestry tended to have the most active form of the gene or variations that made the gene the most active. So in other words, making them much more sensitive to sugar than people with these other types of ancestry, which had genetic variations that seemed to make the gene less active.
What sort of evolutionary advantage would that confer?
Well, it's a good question, Rob. And the idea is, at least as proposed by these scientists, is that in tropical latitudes, there is much more sugary foods. And so you don't really need to have that sensitivity to sugar because you're surrounded by sugar all the time. But in the more northern latitudes, these sugary foods or these sugary plants, plants with a lot of carbohydrates, are harder to come by. And so you really want to have that sensitivity. So if you run across a plant like that, you're going to know that this is a food you should consume because it has a lot of useful calories. At least, you know, that was the case, you know, many thousands of years ago. And the idea is that those sort of adaptations stuck in the genes. And so that even today, people with European ancestry still have that genetic legacy of having this higher sensitivity to sweet foods than people with, say, African ancestry.
Did the researchers test whether the sensitivity to sugar played out in other foods, or this was just in a sugary solution?
Right. It's just in a sugary solution in this study. And what are the applications to real life? Does this mean that, you know, say Europeans are less likely to put sugar in their coffee or less likely to put syrup on their pancakes? And that's still an open question. But one thing that's really important to realize with this research is that, first of all, genes only account for about half of our sugar sensitivity. There's a lot of other things that play roles, such as how old we are and the hormones that are circulating around in our bodies. And there's probably other genes as well that play a role in sugar sensitivity. So taken all together, just because this gene is saying that somebody has a high sensitivity to sugar, that's not the whole story.
Okay, so last story this week. What's this one about?
Well, Rob, from a sweet tooth to growing new teeth, and once they have fallen out, maybe if you've eaten too many sugary foods, this last story is about growing new teeth in mice.
From what?
Well, as you know, Rob, there's a lot of artificial options for us out there if we lose our teeth. You can have artificial teeth put in, you can have implants put in, you can have dental bridges put in, but nobody's really found a way to actually create a new tooth in our mouth de novo. And so the idea is using, you know, stem cells and using bioengineering, can researchers find a way to grow a new tooth in somebody's mouth? And what they did in this study was they worked with mice and they started with something called a tooth germ. And you can think of this as a very preliminary tooth. It's basically the cells that will eventually develop into a full-grown adult tooth. And there's two types of cells. There's what's called epithelial cells and mesenchymal cells. And what the researchers did was they took these tooth germs, they isolated these cell types out of them, then they recombined them with bioengineering, and they implanted them in the space left in a mouse mouth where a molar used to be. So they extracted a molar from a mouse and put this tooth germ in there.
Where do these cells originally come from?
The cells originally come from mouse embryos. So we're talking about very preliminary cells. But the idea with humans is you'd actually start with the patient's own stem cells. So the idea would be that, you know, Rob, if you lost a tooth, I would actually maybe be able to harvest some cells, potentially even from your skin, transform them into these very preliminary epithelial and mesenchymal cells and implant them into your mouth and it would grow a new tooth. Well, they're not quite there yet, but they did show that in mice that the approach worked. After about 50 days, they saw these tooth germs form into what looked like real mouse teeth.
So they bonded with the jaw, they had nutrients provided to them, everything.
Right. So the teeth didn't just look like real teeth, they acted like real teeth. They formed all of the right nerve connections that they were supposed to form and all the other things that normal teeth do in the mouth rather than just sitting there. They actually seem to really be interacting with their environment like a normal tooth does.
So just as if the mouse hadn't lost the tooth at all.
Pretty much. I mean, these teeth, while they look right and they act right, they aren't exactly perfect. Some experts have pointed out that the cusps on the tooth aren't in the exact position they should be. And the crown widths and the patterning of the teeth aren't also exactly normal. And the researchers say these are minor points that they can sort of fix with further research. But it is a really big step in trying to get from no tooth to a real tooth.
So still some cell signaling things to work out.
Still a lot of basic biology to work out, yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, a couple stories that we're looking into is solving the mystery of itch in humans. What makes us itch in the first place, and how related is itch to pain? It's been a big controversy in the neuroscience field, and there's some really interesting new findings coming on that. And then also a study that very closely mimics an Aesop fable, which is about how rooks can drop stones into water to catch worms. And for the science policy blog, Science Insider, we're looking into stories about Francis Collins, who's been nominated to be NIH director, and how that process is going. And we've also got a few items up about swine flu. Some new cases have shown up in Canadian pigs, and also some guidelines about when people should be vaccinated against the virus. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.